KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
More mass layoffs, more worries about policies and political deals infringing on the judicial process, more attacks on Ukraine's president.
We'll walk through what President Trump did this week, what mattered and what didn't.
For Friday, February 21st, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Adrian Florido. We'll head to the annual Conservative Political Action Conference, where people are cheering on every Trump move.
And we'll hear about the legal effort to block Trump's cuts to science research.
Most of the White House action has been in the form of executive orders. There's a split among Republicans on Capitol Hill about how this all plays out in budget bills.
The key divide, whether or not to make big cuts to Medicaid.
Plus, what's the top of mind for high schoolers?
And it may still be the depths of winter, but never fear, spring training is underway.
We'll hear from a game in Arizona.
This and more after this newscast.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Janine Herbst. The acting director of U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement has been removed from his post. NPR's Joel Rose reports the shakeup at ICE comes amid frustrations in the Trump administration at the pace of deportations.
President Trump picked a career ICE official, Caleb Vitello, as the acting head of the agency. Now Vitello has been removed from that post, according to a statement from the Department of Homeland Security, though he will remain at ICE, leading the office that's responsible for arrests and deportations. ICE arrests are up compared to the previous administration, but not enough to satisfy the White House. President Trump promised during the campaign to build the biggest deportation operation in U.S. history. Administration officials have said they want to see at least 1,200 immigration arrests per day nationwide, but ICE field offices have been falling well short of those goals. Joel Rose, NPR News, Washington.
The Trump administration plans to gut the federal office that funds homelessness programs. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports massive staff cuts would come as the number of people without housing is at a record high.
Trump's efficiency team, DOGE, wants to cut staff at the Federal Housing Agency by half, but the office that funds homelessness would lose more, 84%, according to a document NPR has seen. Ann Oliva with the National Alliance to End Homelessness says that would go far beyond Washington, D.C.
We are talking about staff who directly support their communities in field offices all over the country.
A spokesperson says the housing agency continues to carry out its critical functions. Local nonprofits are waiting to receive several billion dollars for rent and other support to keep people off the streets. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Health officials say the measles outbreak in West Texas has now grown to 90 cases. As vaccination rates drop and cases rise across the country, experts say some groups of adults may need to get revaccinated. NPR's Maria Godoy has more.
Measles is incredibly contagious. Dr. William Schaffner of Vanderbilt University says the best defense is vaccination.
If you have been vaccinated with two doses of vaccine as per routine, you have a 95%+ chance of being completely protected throughout your life.
However, if you were vaccinated before 1968, talk to your doctor about getting revaccinated because early versions of the measles vaccine did not work as well as the current shot. People vaccinated between 1968 and 1989 got one dose of the vaccine. In most cases, experts say that's plenty of protection. Certain people, such as those living amidst the measles outbreak, should ask their doctor if they need a second dose. Maria Godoy, NPR News.
And you're listening to NPR News from Washington. Los Angeles Mayor Karen Bass has dismissed Fire Chief Kristen Crowley, who led the response to last month's deadly wildfires. McKenna Severson of member station LAist has more.
Bass said in a news conference that she's acting in the best interest of LA's public safety and the operations of the fire department.
We all know that 1,000 firefighters that could have been on duty on the morning the fires broke were instead sent home on Chief Crowley's watch.
Crowley, who was sworn into office nearly 3 years ago, was the department's first female and LGBTQ fire chief. Former Chief Deputy Ronnie Villanueva will serve as the interim fire chief while a national search is underway. Bass has faced criticism for being abroad the day the fires began. She has faulted Crowley for failing to alert her about the potentially explosive fire conditions. For NPR News, I'm Mackenna Sievertson in Los Angeles.
The Associated Press is suing the Trump administration for barring it from major events over its refusal to refer to the Gulf of Mexico as the Gulf of America. President Trump signed an executive order on his first day in office renaming the body of water between Mexico and Florida, but that only pertains to the U.S. The AP says the Constitution does not allow the government to control speech. Mexico's president, Claudia Sheinbaum, this week threatened to sue Google because it's changed the name on its maps to reflect Trump's EO and call it the Gulf of America. Wall Street sharply lower by the closing bell. I'm Janine Herbst, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Lemelson Foundation, working to harness the power of invention and innovation to accelerate climate action and improve lives around the world. Learn more at lemelson.org. This is NPR.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. It has now been 1 month since President Trump was sworn in for a second term, and the pace has been unrelenting. Mass firings in the federal government, resignations in protest, and controversial foreign policy moves. And that's all just this week. Here to talk about what exactly happened and what it all means is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Hey, Domenico.
Hey, great to be with you, Scott.
Let's start with the comments about Ukraine. This is a country that just marked the start of the third year of Russia invading it. Now Trump is criticizing Ukraine's president. What is going on?
I mean, it was quite the back and forth. It got pretty personal. Ukraine's President Volodymyr Zelensky was pretty upset that his country was left off of initial talks between the U.S. delegation and their Russian counterparts in Saudi Arabia. That led to Trump responding actually to a question that was about whether the U.S. would support the idea of elections in Ukraine, which has been a talking point that Russia has pushed. Mm-hmm. He said he did want to see that. But elections, of course, during wartime are incredibly logistically problematic, especially when it was Russia itself that invaded and has been bombing Ukrainian towns and infrastructure. Never mind that Putin has largely kept himself in power for the last 20 of 25 years in Russia. Trump, though, then went on to blame Ukraine for, quote, starting it and that they should have ended it and gotten a deal in these past 3 years.
Fair to say this did not go over well with Zelensky.
No, it did not. I mean, Zelensky said that he needs to hear more, quote, truth from the Trump team, and Trump didn't appreciate that, as you can imagine. He wound up calling Zelensky a dictator. A lot of Republican elected leaders, even those who've sparred with Trump in the past and have been on Ukraine's side, have said that it's a bad idea for Zelensky to publicly criticize Trump.
Meanwhile, the biggest by far domestic storyline of the Trump administration is this DOGE initiative led by billionaire CEO Elon Musk. The two of them had that big impromptu press conference in the Oval Office last week. At this point, do we have a better sense of what they're trying to do?
Yeah, and I mean, that meeting was really quite striking. I mean, the scene with Musk in the Oval Office, you know, wearing a black Make America Great Again hat, standing next to the president, seated behind the Resolute desk.
Like looming over him.
Yeah, I mean, just standing there with his son with him there. You know, he was explaining that DOGE, the informal Department of Government Efficiency that he leads, is making an effort to tackle bureaucracy and to decrease the national deficit and debt. Well, I mean, this week he even took to the CPAC stage at the Conservative Political Action Conference just outside Washington, D.C., proudly wielding a chainsaw. He was really leaning into this image of him slashing the federal government and federal workforce. But those cuts that his group is making to the federal bureaucracy are minuscule in relation to the overall federal budget. On top of that, Musk even floated this week the idea of a $5,000 DOGE dividend check based on the cuts that his team makes. But we know that the cuts that DOGE is touting don't don't quite add up to as much as they're saying. Plus, Trump is pushing for tax cuts, and those are expected to cost some $5 trillion. All of that's only going to add to the federal debt.
Another storyline last week, several federal prosecutors in New York stepped down over the decision to suspend charges against New York's Mayor Eric Adams. Did that continue to play into politics this week?
It did. We saw four deputy mayors in New York resign because of what a lot of people see as a quid pro quo for the Democratic mayor, helping the Trump team with immigration in the city. We saw that the deputy acting attorney general, Emil Beauvais, go to court asking a judge to suspend the corruption charges against Adams for national security purpose so he could, quote, get back to work unburdened and unhindered. It led to New York's governor pushing for more guardrails on the independence of a New York mayor. So New York is really trying to push back against the Trump administration. It's another indicator of Trump's, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours approach.
A month in, any sense how this is playing with the public?
Yeah, we're starting to have a better idea of that with a couple new polls that are out this week. The bottom line is that it looks like that the honeymoon for Trump appears to be over. Mm-hmm. The country has largely always been split on Trump, slight majority disapproving, and that's what we saw in back-to-back polls with CNN and Washington Post Ipsos. People were split on Trump's approach to the presidency, approach to immigration, rather, but both polls found a majority think that he's exceeding his power as president. CNN's poll also found that 62% think that he hasn't done enough to reduce the price of goods. Of course, tariffs have been a big part of the conversation. We saw that some volatility in the stock market over a lot of this, something people are paying attention to. You know, so we'll see what Trump continues to pursue here, but this flood the zone strategy can really have two sides. You can confuse opponents, but it also makes you seem less focused on the issues that matter to people. And we know that the economy is what helped him over the finish line in the presidential election in the first place.
Right. That is NPR senior political editor and correspondent Domenico Montanaro. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
22 states and a coalition of research institutions were in federal court today. They were trying to block the Trump administration from reducing a key type of medical research funding in the United States. Also this week, the National Science Foundation fired 10% of its workforce. Here with more are NPR science correspondents Rob Stein and Jonathan Lambert. Hey, guys.
Hey, Adrian.
Rob, let's start with you. News from the courtroom today. What is this case about?
This is a huge case for biomedical research. A federal judge in Boston is deciding the legality of a cap the Trump administration wants to put on these certain research expenses. The policy change was announced suddenly 2 weeks ago, stunning medical researchers from coast to coast. The administration wants to limit what the National Institutes of Health spends on overhead, what's known as indirect costs, at 15% of the direct grant money that goes to fund the research. Indirect costs go towards stuff like, you know, maintaining buildings, paying electric bills, administrative staff, IT, all the stuff they need to keep the labs going. Mm-hmm. And 15% is far lower than the 50 or even 60% that many universities and other research institutes get. This is a system that's been in place for decades and that many credit for making the U.S. a global leader in medical research. So the change could fundamentally change the search for new cures in this country.
So what happened in court today?
So the cap has been on hold because of a temporary restraining order imposed by Federal District Court Judge Angel Kelly. Today, she heard almost 2 hours of arguments from the lawyers representing the 22 states, as well as the research institutions that filed 3 lawsuits challenging the cap. They want the temporary block to be permanent. They argue that the cap would cause devastating, even irreparable harm to medical research and is illegal because it violates federal laws about how the NIH sets these rates through negotiations with research institutions. On the flip side, an attorney representing the Trump administration argued that the administration is fully within its rights to do this. He noted that private foundations pay far less for indirect costs and argued that many institutions could cover the costs themselves by eliminating waste or dipping into their endowments. He also challenged the idea that this is a cut in funding for medical research. He says the cap would free up about $4 billion that could be redirected to fund even more research.
So what happens now, Rob?
So the judge indefinitely extended the temporary restraining order, halting the cap from going into effect, and told the lawyers she'd rule as quickly as she can. During the hearing, she peppered both sides with tough questions, but didn't really give any indication which way she's leaning. But the stakes are very high. I recently visited a scientist at the University of Maryland who studies how respiratory illnesses spread. He told me he'd have to lay off half the people in his lab if the cap goes into effect.
Wow.
And that's a scenario I've heard repeated throughout the country.
So, John, bring us up to speed on what's happened this week at the National Science Foundation.
Yeah, on Tuesday morning, 168 of the agency's roughly 1,700 employees got fired without severance. A spokesperson said that the firings were to comply with President Trump's recent executive order aimed at reducing the federal workforce. NSF is the biggest funder of basic science research in the U.S. It's got a budget of about $9 billion, and most of that goes to scientists and at universities and other institutions to fund everything from astrophysics to civil engineering research. And these cuts could really jeopardize that science.
What do we know about the people who were fired?
The firings targeted most of the agency's probationary employees, who have fewer job protections than permanent feds, and all their temporary analysts were let go. Many fired staff were program officers who oversee tens of millions of dollars worth of grants in specific fields like cybersecurity or polar research. Several I spoke to had recently completed their one-year probationary periods, but NSF changed their status back to probationary in January and then fired them. Many of the fired employees were told that they were being terminated for poor performance, but many who I spoke with say they got great performance reviews, and that raises some questions about the legality of these firings.
John, you know, what effect could this all have on the agency's ability to fund research?
Yeah, much like what Rob said about the NIH, the impacts at NSF could be really huge. Staff there are already stretched very thin, and this will make it a lot harder for the agency to do its work evaluating grant proposals and funding new research. Ultimately, that could slow or even stall discoveries in whole disciplines, depending on how hard they were hit. I spoke with Mike Steele, who was fired this week. He worked at an NSF office dedicated to protecting U.S. research from foreign interference. He says that between firings and resignations, his office is down to just 3 people from around 16. And he says that just hamstrings their ability to make sure that U.S. research isn't misused or even stolen by foreign adversaries.
So what's next for the National Science Foundation?
More cuts likely. NSF staff have been told to expect that anywhere from 25 to 50% of them could lose their job soon. And they're expecting potentially billions of dollars cut from their budget. Altogether, that would be just an enormous blow to U.S. science.
Rob, back to the NIH. It's the world's largest public funder of biomedical research. Right. You know, what else is happening there?
Yeah, there's a lot going on. The NIH was swept up with this wave of federal layoffs hitting the government as well. The NIH lost about 1,200 employees throughout the agency. And, you know, although the NIH is supposed to be able to continue to review and approve new grants, I recently learned that that's been put on hold, too. The NIH has been barred from posting notices in the Federal Register. Now, that may sound archaic, but that technicality prevents the NIH from convening meetings, really important meetings, necessary to review and approve billions of dollars of grants.
I've been speaking with NPR science correspondents Rob Stein and Jonathan Lambert. Thanks so much, you two.
You bet.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Fisher Investments. Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at fisherinvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From Procter & Gamble, maker of Metamucil psyllium fiber supplements to support daily digestive health by trapping and removing waste. Learn more at metamucil.com. And from ECMC Foundation at ecmcfoundation.org.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Adrian Florido.
And I'm Scott Detrow. Your 17-year-old self walks into a room and sits down in front of a microphone. Someone you've never met before asks you about your life. What would you say? That is the premise of Small True Things. Audio producer Samantha Brown interviews high school students about, well, the small true things in their lives. The breakups, the bullies, the budding hopes and dreams. Today, we bring you a few of these portraits for our weekly segment of short-form audio documentaries.
What do I love about football? I feel like it's just the fact that it's the only sport where you can get a, like, you really get away with hitting someone. I can hit you for free and talk trash doing it. When someone's running at me, I'm like, let's go. I'm happy. Let's be my turn to make a tackle. If you shy away from the moment, that's how you get hurt. So you get hurt, you get trucked, you get embarrassed. No, I go full speed and I'm coming as hard as I can. I'm a very skinny guy. I don't think I can just like grab someone. Just so like I just chop. Like I run full speed and like I just clip the legs. Being on your edge during a football game is the craziest thing ever. Like may not knowing if you're gonna win the game is the craziest thing. While you're playing is the craziest thing ever. There's nothing more exciting. Not that I faced yet. My name is Sean King, 18.
My name is Gabriel. I like to explore a lot, like abandoned buildings and stuff. And I feel like a lot of people don't know that that's like a hobby, like that's a thing at all. Every single time I go into a building, I am afraid I'm going to get caught. A lot of times there are security in these places despite them being abandoned, but you just kind of push through that. And that gives you kind of like this adrenaline rush. At the same time, you're kind of like excited to like see what this place once was. Oftentimes I like to explore with my best friend. And a lot of the times we just look around and we're like, ooh, the boss probably sat here one day. But we just like to make scenarios out of what could have happened or like what the building was. When we go into buildings, we try to not damage the place because that's just disrespectful and rude. People can reuse the buildings. Buildings can be used for whole other purposes. So to damage them is you're just making sure that people will never be able to go back there again. You just kind of want people to be there again.
I first realized I was a writer in preschool when I took some pages and I cut them up and I put them into a tiny little paper book and I wrote the Black Rapunzel. Yeah. My name is Sardwan. I'm 15 years old. I watched Rapunzel and I was like, oh my goodness, wouldn't this be so great if it was a book? But it was me instead of Rapunzel, and I drew my afro super long and it had all the world inside of it and I loved it. Like, I'm planning on writing 43 different books because I have 43 writing plans in my notebooks. If I had 50, I would write 50. I like to write fantasy and I like to write mystery, but the one that I'm currently writing is basically about this character who is living the day over and over and over again on a loop. Like, kind of like if you ever heard of Groundhog Day or stories like that. To be able to say that I'm a writer means to me that it's like my like calling or like my passion. I think that's what people say when they find something that is really important to them that they could see themselves doing for the rest of their lives.
I love romance. I love watching like K-dramas. I love reading romance books. I love love. Love is amazing. My name is Derek. I am 16 years old. For me, what makes a good romance story is an unlikable main character. They're not perfect when they start out in the book, But through the challenges they overcome with this person, they realized, huh, I'm a better person when I'm with this person, and I love being around them. I want to change more. My relationship was like liking romance. I have had like times where I have shared that to the wrong people and they have made fun of me for it. But I really hope that in the future, some guy or myself will find the bravery to write a romance book for all those guys that truly need it, and that it becomes something big so people can realize romance isn't just for girls. Guys like it too. We like romance. We like being hopeless romantics. We want to hear these stories and relate to it. And yeah, no one can deny that love is the thing that we need most of on Earth. With love, anything can happen. Love is amazing.
I know how to change a tire. Not only change it, but I know how to take the rim off a tire and put a new tire on it. I know how to fill a tire. I know what connects the brakes, what to do in an emergency, so if your brakes stop working. My name is Izzy. I love working on cars. Like, if you know me, you know that, but if you don't, you look at me and you don't see that. My stepdad's an auto mechanic, and he used to take me with him to work sometimes. And I was always so fascinated, like, what do they do in there? Like, a car goes in broken, it comes out fixed. How do you do that? And my mom would go, or my sister would go to get her oil changed, and I'm like, I started asking him questions. Like, why do you have to change the oil in the car? What do you do when your engine light turns on? What do you check first? Like, I was asking questions like that. And then one day he was working on a car, and I went down with him, and he was explaining stuff to me. I can't remember exactly what, but that's what, like, sparked it. Like, so I love doing that with my stepdad. I love, like, working on cars because I do want to be an auto mechanic.
My name is Jose. I am currently a senior. As far as me as a person, I'm usually just keeping to myself. It's not that I don't like to talk to people. I tend to get awkward with social interaction, so I just tend to avoid it. In school, it was not exactly great. I was kind of seen, at least in elementary, I was kind of seen as the stereotypical weird kid. A lot of my peers just kind of stayed away from me. And whenever they did interact with me, it was usually at my expense. For the most part, I would just try to ignore it, and that didn't really help. Throughout all this, I never told my mom or anybody else about how bad it was. And I think it was last year that I finally had a heartfelt conversation with my mom. It was hard because I had it all boiling there for a while, but it was also relieving when I finally expressed how the whole experience made me feel. As a kid, I tended to just ignore my own needs, and if I had to go back and tell my younger self something, it'd be stand up for yourself because you matter just as much as anybody else.
That was Jose Ayala, Izzy Fuentes, Derek Matos Huertas, Sarduan Kapenga Njibu, Gabriel Villar, and Sharking Lovett. They spoke with audio producer Samantha Brown for her project Small True Things. You can hear more of these portraits at smalltruethings.org.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Another week of job cuts at key U.S. government agencies. We'll look at who's getting cut, what those cuts might mean. Also, Germans head to the polls this weekend as concerns over immigration and the economy increase support for the far right. And we'll have the latest on the hostages released out of Gaza. Those stories Saturday on Weekend Edition from NPR News.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Adrian Florido. It's cold, it's dark, it's windy.
But in Florida and Arizona, baseball players are getting ready for the season.
The latest on spring training and the big storylines in baseball.
Today, that includes a major announcement by the New York Yankees.
They're finally allowing their players to, wait for it, grow beards.
First news.
Live from NPR News in Culver City, California, I'm Dwayne Brown. A federal judge is allowing the Trump administration to put thousands of U.S. Agency for International Development staff on administrative leave. NPR's Fatma Tanis has the latest.
Unions representing agency employees lost their bid to challenge the administration's moves to dismantle America's aid agency. 2 weeks ago, Judge Carl Nichols had issued a pause on the moves to put most of the agency's staff on administrative leave and bring back foreign service officers who are posted overseas, many in conflict zones, within 30 days. The unions argued that dismantling the agency would put its overseas staff in danger and cut them off from communication and resources. Judge Nichols said the unions failed to prove irreparable harm to the employees and removed the temporary block. The administration has significantly downsized USAID. Only 600 people out of the more than 10,000 will be allowed to continue working. Fatma Tanis, NPR News.
The federal judge overseeing the corruption case against New York City Mayor Eric Adams has opted not to rule immediately on the Justice Department's request to drop the prosecution. Instead, the judge has appointed an outside attorney to present an independent perspective. Here's Ryan Lucas.
U.S. District Judge Dale Ho has appointed Paul Clement as a so-called friend of the court to help consider the Justice Department's unopposed motion to drop the case. Clement served as Solicitor General during the George W. Bush administration. Judge Ho's decision comes days after the Justice Department formally requested to dismiss the Adams case. The department says the request isn't based on the strength of the case. Instead, it says the prosecution hinders Adams' ability to help the Trump administration with immigration enforcement. The interim U.S. attorney in Manhattan and at least six other senior Justice Department attorneys resigned in protest. Ryan Lucas, NPR News, Washington.
This is NPR. In Hong Kong, the six-week-old trial of media mogul Jimmy Lai is being closely watched. The billionaire has been charged with colluding with foreign countries, among other charges. NPR's Emily Fang has more.
Jimmy Lai founded the now shuttered news outlet Apple Daily that often criticized the Chinese government. He has remained in jail for nearly 4 years as a trial date for his national security case was set. Last November, he started giving his first oral testimony. This week, the court grilled him on two editorials he wrote criticizing Beijing and whether they, quote, incited public hatred towards the government. This week, one of Hong Kong's biggest and last remaining opposition political parties also announced they were moving to shut themselves down after years of pressure from Beijing's national security law curtailed nearly all of their political activities. Emily Fang, NPR News, Washington.
Well, shares of United Health Group fell more than 7% today on Wall Street after a report that federal investigators are scrutinizing the way the health insurer bills the government for people on its Medicare Advantage plans. United Health Group is the parent company of United Healthcare, whose CEO Brian Thompson was fatally shot last December in New York City. While stocks fell sharply across the board on Wall Street today as mounting concerns over the economy, consumer confidence, and tariffs continue to persist. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the station
And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes, to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. From the Lodestar Foundation, inspired by the principle that helping someone else less fortunate is a path to a happier, healthier, and more meaningful life. Learn more at LodestarFoundation.org. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Adrian Florido. House Republicans are crafting a budget package that includes President Trump's top agenda items, boosting border security and extending his tax cuts. To pay for it, they're looking for cuts, and a large chunk is expected to come from Medicaid, the federal health care program for poor, elderly, and disabled Americans. NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now to report on the split inside the Republican Party on changes to the program. Welcome, Deirdre.
Hey, Adrian.
First, can you just explain why House Republicans are looking for savings for Medicaid?
So the House Republican budget calls for up to $2 trillion in cuts to pay for extending Trump's tax cuts for another decade. Those are due to expire at the end of 2025. There's only so much you can cut from the discretionary side of the budget, the annual spending bills. The vast majority of the federal budget is spent on mandatory programs like Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid. So various committees are crafting details on where to get these cuts from. And the one panel that oversees health programs is tasked with coming up with over $800 billion in cuts. The expectation is most of those will come from Medicaid.
But Deirdre, correct me if I'm wrong, hasn't President Trump declared that he wouldn't touch Medicaid?
He did. Earlier this week in an interview on Fox News, the president said that, and he campaigned on not touching entitlement programs. But a day after insisting that Medicaid is off the table, he endorsed the House Republican budget proposal that includes this plan to target the program for savings to come up with the $4.5 trillion they're going to need to pay for these tax cuts. House Speaker Mike Johnson has insisted Medicaid benefits are not at risk and says their budget is targeting waste, fraud, and abuse in Medicaid.
But is there any expectation that Republicans can find hundreds of billions of dollars in waste? How could they change Medicaid?
I mean, that's a big number, and it's not expected they can get those kinds of savings, so Republicans are looking at other reforms. Ideas that conservatives have pushed for years in terms of reforming Medicaid, adding work requirements for adults who aren't caring for small children, tying their health care benefits to working or training for a job. Some conservatives are also talking about shifting Medicaid to the states more, limiting how much the federal program pays to the states for each Medicaid beneficiary. That could increase the state's share of the program.
Are all Republicans on board with these proposals?
No. I mean, in the last week, we have seen some moderate Republicans warn they have concerns and could vote no. One freshman Republican, Rahm Bresnahan from Pennsylvania, issued a statement after the House budget was adopted by the Budget Committee last week. He said, if a bill, quote, is put in front of me that guts the benefits my neighbors rely on, I will not vote for it. There's also a group of Republican lawmakers who represent districts with large number of Hispanic constituents, and they say Medicaid cuts could have serious consequences for their constituents. Remember, there's just a small, tiny Republican majority. The speaker can afford to lose one vote.
Yeah.
So it's going to take near unanimity next week.
And are GOP lawmakers hearing anything from constituents themselves?
You know, it's still early in the process, and this is just the first step. But one of Trump's campaign pollsters, Tony Fabrizio, released a poll of swing state House districts that shows that federal assistance to pay for health insurance is really popular with Trump voters and swing voters. There was also a town hall in a Republican district in Georgia last night where some voters did push back at the idea of cutting back some of these federal programs.
That's NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thanks, Deirdre.
Thank you.
The annual Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, is underway just outside of Washington, D.C. This year's event comes 1 month into President Trump's return to office, a return that has seen a dizzying array of executive actions and efforts to reshape the federal government. NPR's Stephen Fowler joins us from CPAC, where Trump is set to speak tomorrow. Hi, Stephen.
Hey, Scott.
Set the scene for us.
So I just stepped out into the lobby of this massive hotel conference center on my way outside the convention main hall, past a media row. There's attendees milling about. I saw conservative podcasters and streamers polling audience members to talk about Trump's latest actions. There's an exhibition hall where people are advocating for conservative causes around healthcare, selling January 6th related merchandise. Yesterday opened up with a conversation with Vice President J.D. Vance defending recent remarks he made at a conference in Munich, and he shared his views on masculinity. But so far, the biggest reaction and the undercurrent of CPAC has been Elon Musk, the billionaire Trump advisor tasked with overseeing the Doge effort that's implementing Trump's vision to shrink spending, scope, and size of the federal government. He spoke Thursday.
I mean, Musk has been the overwhelming storyline of the Trump administration so far. What did he say at CPAC, and how has the Doge effort been received by the crowd?
He came out like a rock star. He had sunglasses on, a dark gothic MAGA hat, as he described it. He was handed a golden chainsaw from the president of Argentina as a nod to cutting bureaucracy. He was treated like a rock star in one of his interviews that he did with a conservative TV host and by the attendees that gave him some of the biggest applause out of anyone I've seen here so far. So many other speakers, Scott, also nodded to Doge and its mentality of rooting out waste, fraud, and abuse, taking it to the deep state, including conservative speakers from other countries that say that he's a model. I guess I wouldn't say that Doge is the new MAGA per se, but it's the latest version of this populist, anti-establishment brand of conservatism that only a few people can wield, but plenty are on board with.
And President Trump is going to speak during the final day of the conference tomorrow. He is often made a lot of headlines with CPAC speeches. What should we expect to hear from him?
Well, pretty much everything that's happened at CPAC this week is a preview of Trump 2.0. I mean, I was struck by comments from Senator Jim Banks of Indiana, who said Trump has already accomplished so many things, rooting out that massive waste, fraud, and abuse, crippling the deep state. He mentioned the largest ever deportation effort in American history. And so many of the cabinet secretaries have also been here speaking about Trump's agenda and how it fits in with what they're doing and the successes. We had the Attorney General, the Energy Secretary, the Housing and Urban Development Secretary. It's also a peak example of how almost everything in the GOP and the conservative arena right now has just been subsumed into Trumpism. And Scott, it's only been a month, and many of Trump's actions have been held up by the courts or will take time to implement. But I wouldn't be surprised to see Trump's speech here be treated like the opening of a victory lap.
Yeah, that is NPR's Stephen Fowler speaking to us from CPAC in National Harbor, Maryland. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Considered from NPR News. People like to talk. We're unique in the animal kingdom in terms of how much we communicate and the kinds of information we discuss. Scientists are trying to understand how this special trait evolved at the genetic level. NPR's Nell Greenfield-Boyce reports on what happened recently when researchers gave mice the human version of one particular gene.
If someone asked you what kind of sound a mouse makes, you'd probably go, squeak. But mice also make some sounds in the ultrasonic range that humans can't hear. If you process those sounds so that we can hear them, it's a lot like bird song. Eric Jarvis is a researcher at Rockefeller University in New York. He says mouse pups chirp when they're taken away from their mothers, and as adults, male mice string long sequences of these chirps together.
And they'll sing them to the females as a courtship behavior.
Recently, Jarvis teamed up with some other researchers at Rockefeller University to study one particular gene. This gene is found in living creatures from mammals to birds, but there's one particular variant that's found only in people. When they put that uniquely human variant into mice, it subtly changed the vocalizations made by babies and adult males. Jarvis says their analysis showed that the mouse songs became more complex.
So the fact that we had a change in the vocal behavior was really exciting.
He says this gene could be related to speech and language, although it's clearly not the only language gene.
I don't think that one gene is going to be responsible, poof, and you got spoken language, right?
Still, this gene is especially intriguing because it's active in the brain, and this variant seems to be only found in modern humans. Robert Darnell is a neuroscientist, also at Rockefeller University. He says they've looked at genetic information in databases and found that this variant is present in almost every single person from around the world, but it's not found in chimps or extinct human species like Neanderthals.
This is a human language gene that changed and switched early in the development of Homo sapiens.
A report on the findings appears in the journal Nature Communications, and it's got the attention of other scientists interested in the genetic underpinnings of language. Cedric Books is with the Catalan Institute for Advanced Studies and Research and the University of Barcelona. He says it's a real advance.
It's one gene among many still to be uncovered in a complex network that influence this and make possible this capacity we have.
He cautions, though, that it's hard to make a jump from mouse vocalizations to human speech. A mouse is not your typical vocal learner.
It produces vocalizations, but they are mostly innately constrained. So it's not like us.
He says humans are special in how we communicate, and knowing the list of genes involved in language could tell us something about how humans came to be who we are. Nell Greenfield Boyce, NPR News.
Listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Adrian Florido. A high-stakes showdown is brewing between a federal judge and Trump administration officials at the United States Agency for International Development. At issue, the Trump administration's shutoff of federal funding to thousands of organizations that do aid and other work around the globe. A judge has twice ordered USAID to restart millions of dollars in payments, but for the past week, the Trump administration has not complied. NPR's Frank Langfitt joins us now with more. Hey, Frank.
Hey, Adrian.
Dozens of lawsuits, Frank, have been filed against the Trump administration over its efforts to gut federal agencies. Why does this case stand out?
You know, Adrian, there are a couple of reasons. One is, as people remember, USAID was the first agency that the Trump administration targeted. And the other thing is, this is the case that is among the farthest along in the courts in what could be a face-off between the U.S. government's executive and judicial branch, what we often refer to as a constitutional crisis.
So explain what the dispute in this case is.
Yeah, it's actually pretty simple. Trump sent officials into USAID, and they shut off funding to these thousands of aid organizations around the world that you were mentioning.
Right.
Now, some of these organizations, they sued, saying this was causing irreparable harm to them, and the judge agreed and ordered USAID to start paying again.
And it sounds like the government is refusing to do that?
It has so far. It hasn't. This has been about a week or so, and it still hasn't. The government says, Adrian, that it's got this right to review and cancel grants and contracts based on the terms of the contracts. And USAID says it's doing that now on a case-by-case basis. Now, the judge says, yeah, that's true, but he's ordered USAID, as you said, to keep paying these organizations the money they're actually owed while the case plays out in court. And earlier this week, USAID said it had already canceled nearly 500 contracts. Now, some of that was because they focused on diversity, equity, and inclusion. Others because they promoted sustainability and combated climate change. Now, USAID says they haven't killed, you know, all the foreign contracts. They say they spared about 20. They're worth about $250 million. But Adrian, that is a tiny fraction of what the agency actually spends every year.
Yeah.
On an annual basis, it's about $40 billion in about 130 countries.
Based on everything that you've just been describing, I mean, it sounds like this is a standoff between federal judge and Trump officials. You know, where is this case heading?
Well, here's where it is right now. I mean, the plaintiffs have asked the judge to find USAID and the State Department in contempt of court, and that would be a big deal, effectively saying the Trump administration is ignoring a federal court order and pitting the administration against the court. The judge has not done that yet. But if you read his orders, you can see that he's losing patience with the government. I'll give you an example. He wrote that his order, quote, does not permit defendants to simply continue their blanket suspension of congressionally appropriated foreign aid, which, Adrian, is judge speak for stop ignoring my order.
Yeah. Frank, this is going on in a court just over a mile away from our studios, just up the street here. How is this funding shutdown, though, playing out around the globe?
It's profound. I mean, I was talking to a guy, a member of a banned Cambodian political party, and he has to vacate a safe house with his family because USAID is no longer funding that safe house, and he's afraid that he's going to get picked up police and sent to prison. He's one of 35 people who've had to leave. Another example, an investigative journalism group, they look at transnational corruption. They've had to lay off a quarter of their reporters and support staff. And here in D.C., Freedom House, they do annual surveys of political freedom around the world. They're laying off 76 people, and that's slated for April.
So, Frank, what's next in this case?
Well, the judge has told the government and plaintiffs they need to meet by next Wednesday to discuss the government's compliance with paying, and it looks like a pressure tactic by the judge. And if the government continues to dig in its heels, I'm pretty sure the plaintiffs will keep pressing for a contempt of court order. And somewhere along the line here, Adrian, something's got to give.
Yeah. That's NPR's Frank Langfitt. Thanks for your reporting.
Good to talk, Adrian.
Baseball is back. It is the second official day of spring training for Major League Baseball, which means the regular season is just a few weeks away. And there are more than usual questions about who is going to come out on top on the field and in revenue. NPR sports correspondent Becky Sullivan joins us now from Arizona. Hey, Becky.
Hey there.
Is it true you are talking to me from the middle of a baseball game?
I am, yeah. I'm standing out behind the outfield of the stadium in Surprise, Arizona, which is out on the edge of the Phoenix metro area. About half the Major League Baseball teams come out here for spring training. And so, yeah, right now I'm watching a game between the Kansas City Royals and the Texas Rangers. For both teams, the first game of spring training. And it's a beautiful day, Scott, about 75 degrees, sunny, thousands of fans here with me. It's pretty great.
I'm going to push past my deep jealousy and ask the next question. What are the big storylines shaping up this season?
Yeah, well, I mean, as you alluded to, I think, in a way, the top two stories for me, I think, are about money. First, you've got the Los Angeles Dodgers, who won the World Series last year, of course, and then spent big in the offseason. Their roster was already star-studded, but they added, went and added even more stars. And so now their payroll's looking to be nearly $400 million, which is more than double about half the other teams in baseball. And then you've got the trouble that a lot of other teams are having, which is maintaining TV revenue, which gives them the money that they need to get players, because there's been this huge shakeup in that business as people have been cutting the cord and turning to streaming.
Yeah, how's that affecting teams?
Well, about half of Major League Baseball teams had TV deals with this provider known to viewers as Bally Sports. And, you know, just as that industry has changed, that company declared bankruptcy. And so as they've gone through that process over the past year or so, they had dropped a bunch of these small market teams, forced some others to accept new deals that paid less. And then on top of that, news came out this week that Major League Baseball and ESPN have opted out of a broadcast contract. So I think this kind of revenue is really a question mark for baseball right now. Meanwhile, you have these big markets like LA and New York that are still going strong, and it's all just fueling worries that there is this like widening gap between the haves and the have-nots in baseball.
And I feel like there's this physical representation of that this year with the have-nots. Two teams are going to be playing in minor league, yep. Minor league stadiums. Remind us about that.
Yeah, exactly. So one of those teams is the A's, who left Oakland after the end of last season after years of failed negotiations between that team's ownership and the city of Oakland to replace this aging stadium there, as the team also just consistently had one of the cheapest payrolls in baseball. So the A's are headed to Las Vegas, but that new stadium won't be ready until 2028. So for now, they're going to have to play at this AAA park in West Sacramento. And then across the country, you have the Tampa Bay Rays, whose home stadium, Tropicana Field, was damaged last fall in Hurricane Milton. So this season, the Rays are playing at the Yankees spring training stadium in Tampa.
Speaking of the Yankees, really big news we got to talk about. They have reversed their teams, and I'm going to quote for the press release, their, quote, longstanding facial hair and grooming policy.
Yep. Can you believe this had been in place for almost 50 years? Pretty famous. Basically, this was a ban on beards and long hair that was put in place by the longtime team owner George Steinbrenner back in the 70s, back when like shaggy hair and scruff was fashionable. So Yankees, they could have mustaches, but they couldn't have beards, and their hair couldn't grow past their uniform collars. Sparked lots of griping over the years, this policy did. Well, George's son Hal runs the team now. He said today that they'll allow the beards as long as they're well-groomed, and basically he's concerned that players were declining the Yankees because of the policy. So big changes afoot in baseball right now, Scott.
You can have your pinstripes, you can have your beard, you can have it all. That's NPR's Becky Sullivan joining us from spring training in Phoenix, where it sounds like an inning just ended. Thanks so much.
You're so welcome.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort, offering small ship experiences with a shore excursion included in every port and programs designed for cultural enrichment. Learn more at Viking.com. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. From Progressive Insurance, Progressive is looking for individuals in a variety of career fields who want to help build a culture of inclusiveness. More information, including application, at progressive.com/career.
A cold-hearted woman who just wouldn't treat me right. I had a cold-hearted woman who just wouldn't treat me right. So I'm walking around in circles, cause I can't sleep a wink at night. Yes, she told me she was through, and then she closed the door.